Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Around here there shall surely be, born to be strong, raised to be free.
Graphic Audio presents Kelvin of Rudd, Book 3, Chimera's Copper, narrated by Dylan Lynch, performed by David Coyne, Michael John Casey, Barbara Penalini, Nick DiPinto, Elizabeth Jernigan, Thomas Penny, Joe Brack, Richard Rowan, Terrence Aselford, Bradley Smith, Christopher Graybill, Ken Jackson, Nanette Savard, Colleen Delaney, Alyssa Wilmoth, Tracy Lynn Oliveira, Kimberly Gilbert, David Harris, Joel David Santner, Michael Glenn, Stephen Carpenter, Eric Messner, Thomas Keegan, James Lewis. Kelvin of Rudd, Book 3, Chimera's Copper.
She knew where she was going. If only she could get there. She had prevailed on the foolish John Knight to bring her this far. Now she had to go on alone. She stepped off the raft and sank into the dark water. One arm was useless, but she could still move the other and her legs. She swam as well as she was able, down, down toward the bottom, not even trying to hold her breath, for it would only buoy her body. Let him go. His usefulness to her was done. The current would carry him into the dread flaw. She found the lock and managed to drag herself into it. In a moment, she came up in the air. She sprawled onto a platform and finally let her consciousness fade. Sometime later, in the dead of the eternal night that ruled here, a figure came. It was gross and masculine.
You've returned, Zoanna.
I need your help, Professor.
I see you have broken bones. I can heal them. What will you pay?
She struggled and managed to turn over so that she lay on her back. She spread her good arm and her good legs and smiled despite the pain. The figure stared down, interested. It reached out to squeeze a breast as if checking its freshness.
For how long?
I want to go to school this time. To learn sorcery. For as long as it takes.
That is long enough.
The wide man had once worn a crown. Now he wore only a torn robe and many bruises as he stepped from the transporter into the empty chamber. This was the world they had come from, he was sure. He had watched from concealment as they climbed the ladder to the ledge. Then he had followed, certain of what he would find, their gateway between worlds. In the otherwise empty chamber on his homeworld, he had not hesitated before using the transporter to follow. What was there for him at home now, as a usurped king? Nothing but death at the hands of Brotmar, his former aide, or some other disgruntled soldier. Or possibly at the hands of Zatanas, his queen's treacherous old father. There was a subtle difference between this chamber and the one he had entered. The one on this world had no exit sign. It was cleaner, and there were no dusty footprints on the floor. But the smooth, sphere-shaped walls were similar, and there was the same magical radiance that lit the machine and the table holding the parchment. He rubbed the bruises on his arms, legs, and face. What treachery Brotmar had shown him. How he would like to go back and destroy the man. Well, someday he might. Meanwhile, he could relax at night by dreaming up torments for his former torture master. He had thought the man worshipped his master above all men and gods. It showed that no underling could be trusted. He read the parchment.
To whom it may concern, if you have found this cell, you are a Roundier, because only a Roundier could penetrate to it without setting off the self-destruct mechanism. I am Muvar, and I am a Roundier. But because the natives look with disfavor on aliens, I masked my ears so that I could work among them without hindrance. I used the technology of my home frame to set things straight, then retired, for it was lonely. I set up the prophecy of my return, or the appearance of any round ear, to facilitate better acceptance in future centuries. The tools of my frame are here, and you may use them as you find necessary. If you wish to contact me directly, seek me in my home frame, where I will be in suspended animation. Directions for using the flaw to travel to the frame of your choice are in the book of instructions beside this letter. Please return any artifacts you borrow. Justice be with you.
The man who had been king looked around and saw no artifacts. There was only the closet-like transporter, the table, the parchment, and the instruction book. He read the book. My, but there was extraordinary power here. He could change the settings and... No, it was better not to tempt fate further. He wanted to leave no evidence of his presence at this time. Later, when he had a better notion of the situation outside the chambers, he might return to do something. All in good time. He was amazed at what he had learned already. Smiling with satisfaction at the change in his fortune, he crossed the chamber to the big, round metal door. The door opened onto a ledge above an underground river. The surface of the water was eerily lit by luminous lichen on the rock walls. And there, as if specially placed for him, was waiting one small boat. With rising excitement, the king launched the boat on the somber river, got into it, and applied himself to the oars. The wood handles, though splintery, fit his hands as well as those he had used at home. He put his back into it, eager to see what destiny had in store for him. Ahead was a black falls with deep, deep darkness, and stars and moving points of light. This was no ordinary night, he knew. It was the dread flaw. He bypassed it, fighting the current. He knew he didn't want to get swept into that horrendous abyss. He guided the boat away from the walls and out into the middle of the water as he rounded the bend. He was getting near to something now, and he was feeling it. He believed it would be his aid to destiny, his aid to conquest. Suddenly, he stopped rowing. He seemed to have no choice. What was guiding him? He gazed down into the water, seeing nothing but his own bruised features. He stood up in the boat, not knowing what he was doing, and peered deep, deep into the murky water. Nothing, not even fish. Only the dim reflections of himself and the boat and the rock walls gliding by, illuminated by the lichen. Yet again, he felt that mysterious impulse. He dived. He dived deeper. Deeper, though his body was growing hungry for air. His arms and legs worked steadily, refusing to be halted by fatigue. Silvery bubbles floated from the corners of his mouth into a tunnel, its smooth walls coated with more glowing lichen, then up, up, and suddenly the water parted. As his panting eased and his vision cleared, he realized that he was in a chamber not dissimilar from the one he had recently left. There was a woman here, holding a crystal ball. She had very red hair and eyes incredibly green. Zanan, his docile queen. But there were two things distinctly different about her. This woman had no bruises, and her expression was not at all submissive. Also, her ears were pointed.
Pointed ears? Zanan?
Rufert, king of all Kelvinia, rode his favorite mare to the ruins of his old palace. With him were two guards with whom he joked in what was his unkingly yet customary fashion.
Stay here!
Around him were piles of ashes, blackened timbers, and the broken statues of former kings of Rud. Almost of their own accord, his feet carried him through the ruins. He went down the three flights of crumbling stairs. There, just as he knew it would be, was the underground river. Standing there on the final landing, he remembered the words of an ancient prophecy.
Around here there shall surely be, born to be strong, raised to be free, fighting dragons in his youth, leading armies, nothing loath, ridding his country of a sore, joining two, then uniting four, until from seven there be one,
Only then will his task be done. Honored by many, cursed by few, all will know what a round ear can do.
Why was he thinking of this? And just why had he climbed down all those awful stairs? Rofirth half turned. As he did, a sudden chill formed somewhere in the region of his heart. It was uncanny what was happening to him. It was something he was sure had never happened before. She stood there behind him, holding a crystal ball. Her hair was as red as dragon sheen, and her eyes the green of feline magic with sparks like tiny stars. Her pointed ears identified her with a horrifying certainty.
Sohanna! Sohanna! I thought you dead!
Yes, one-time king. Once my feeble husband. I have returned to reclaim all that I once had and all that has since been gained for me. I am back to rule, sweet husband. Back to punish the likes of you and to destroy the likes of that Hackleberry brat.
No! No, you drowned! I know you drowned and...
She made a pass over the crystal ball with her hand. A repellent shade of red immediately suffused the crystal. King Rufford clutched his chest in sudden agony.
Yes, yes. Did I ever tell you how pretty your ears are, my erstwhile liege?
When the king finally emerged from the ruins, the sun was setting. His face had somehow gotten bruised, though the bruises had the appearance of those acquired days before.
Your Majesty.
The king went to place his foot in the stirrup that was being held for him. A hoof came for him, grazing his hip.
What's the matter with you, Lomax? Can't you control a stupid horse?
Your Majesty.
The king drew a riding whip from its harness scabbard and lashed the mare across her face.
I can't abide an unruly animal. Catch it and slay it.
But Your Majesty...
Do it, idiot!
Lomax ran after the horse. She had stopped some distance away, her white-rimmed eyes as frightened as he himself felt.
What is going on here?
Here, girl. Here.
The mare let him take the reins, but as he turned to lead her back, he saw that the king had drawn a sword. This time, Lomax deliberately let the reins slip.
Never mind, Your Majesty. I'll catch her again. She caught me by surprise. She isn't usually like this. It may take a little time. Perhaps you would prefer not to wait. It's a long ride to the palace. Another horse.
Yes, another horse in any event. Bring me that roan.
Yes, Your Majesty.
Slatterly held the reins and the king mounted.
You ride ahead of me. Fast. I want to reach the palace by nightfall.
Yes, Your Majesty.
Lomax himself was moving fast, pretending he was going to catch and possibly slay the king's favorite horse. The king all but rode him down.
You! I want you to get that horse.
Yes, Your Majesty. Yes, of course.
And I want you to ride her.
Ride her, Your Majesty?
Until she drops. Ride her to the death.
Majesty, no...
You will do as I order. If you don't, I'll see you in the torture chamber.
But Your Majesty, you haven't got...
Haven't what?
Haven't a torture chamber.
That will be remedied. Now find that horse, ride her till she drops.
Kelvin was not at all happy about returning to the world of Silver Serpents, but Cian had asked him to please come and be his best man, and their father was, after all, going to attend. It was, he vowed, going to be the last time he'd travel there. Kelvin's wife Helen was accompanying them as far as the palace ruins, as was his sister John. Helen was getting into the later stages of her pregnancy, but she had insisted, to his mixed pleasure and dismay.
I still say that a pointy-eared person could use a transporter.
Yes, John. Once. Then there'd be no pointy-eared person and no transporter.
You can't know that.
I know it certainly enough. Look, Brother Wart, has Muvar ever lied to us? You know what that parchment says.
Well, it just doesn't seem right. And I've asked you not to call me that. It makes people think there's a big mole on my nose or something. It might have been cute when I was little and dressed up like a boy, but now...
Right, Sister Wart.
Teasing John again.
She started it.
She always does, doesn't she? Why is it you two can't act like adults?
Because we're brother and irritant.
Predictably, John turned in her saddle... and stuck her tongue out.
Oh, Now that's really adult behavior. Ladylike, too.
Who's a lady? You.
She's got you now, Kel. Ever since St. Helens showed up and talked about female liberation, she hasn't wanted to be one.
She never did, Father. You didn't grow up with her as I did. If she could have grown a penis, she'd have done it.
Don Tootin.
Somehow, I don't think Les would have approved. But she would have interests appropriate to her anatomy.
Kelvin, that's enough.
I think she'd get over that.
Kelvin, you really have to grow up a little. You and your sister both.
Yes, Mom.
I never knew the ruins were so far away.
It's the riding. You're not used to it.
Well, that's for certain. To ease my backside, I'm tempted to use the belt.
John referred to the levitation belt that had been in the Muvar chamber and was now around Kelvin's waist.
That wouldn't look right, Father. You know how nervous people get when they see magic.
Science. Confound it, science. Magic is what that witch had and that the Muvar weapon put a stop to.
But then it has to be magic, doesn't it, Father?
No. At least I don't think so. It's anti-magic. Though it can't be magic, it has to be science.
You know, it just could be we're in some sort of war. Not a war between armies, exactly, but between science and magic.
Horse droppings!
Now, I don't know there, John. Kelvin might just have something. Back on Earth, there was sometimes talk about a war between faith and technology. That was not the same as here, in this frame, or in that frame with the silver serpents, but it's close. Muvar seems to have science, albeit advanced. The citizens of this world, and the one we're going to, don't. Here or there, a sorcerer might fly with a spell, but on Muvar's world, or mine, it would be with a mechanical apparatus or belt.
That's different.
Well, I'd say so. But then you have to remember that I'm from a world and a culture where magic didn't exist. As a boy, I often wished there was magic, but then there were cars and radios and TV sets and airplanes. Unfortunately, there were also scientific horrors that I don't like to think about.
Horseless carriages, talking boxes, glass with moving pictures of sometimes living and sometimes dead people in them? Though why anyone should want to listen to corpses talking, I sure don't know. Machines that fly and what you called atomic explosions? Gee, Father, what would life have been for you if you had just called it magic?
Only Muvar knows. I mean Muvar's people, of course. And possibly others who have lived with both.
Both magic and science? You think that's possible?
That's what I was asking, Sister Ward. I mean, you take these gauntlets, for instance. Are they one, or are they the other? Or are they both?
You know, I wish I could decide. The gauntlets seem magic, but then they do so many things that are science.
I personally don't see what it matters. If something works, why not just accept it? Why do people on Earth have to deny magic anyway?
There you've got me. Magic doesn't follow natural laws, we are told. Magic doesn't follow our logic, so we say it has no logic. Magic simply, unequivocally, can never, ever exist. Why? Because magic is impossible, that's why.
That sounds stupid.
I agree. Magic does exist here, now. But on Earth, where I grew up, things were entirely different. To say you believed in magic was to be laughed at, or worse.
Well, I for one don't believe in science.
You have to believe in cause and effect, John. That's what science basically is. If something happens, it has a cause. I still believe that, only today I often don't know the cause, and so I accept with other people that the cause is magic. I admit it took me some time to get this far. Beliefs are hard to change.
Like the transporter? And the spell on it that will destroy it and me if I try to use it?
If you say so, John. To me, it's science, but the results are certain to be the same. You and Helen rest overnight and then go home once we reach the ruins. I know you'd like to follow, but I know too, as you must, that your trying to follow would be disastrous.
I know. Magic.
Late that day, John repeated her now legendary feat of downing a game bird with her sling. They all enjoyed a hearty meal and a good night's sleep. At least Kelvin slept well, he reflected as they approached the site of the old palace, its blackened stones and burned timbers looking ghostly in the morning mist. He wasn't sure about the others. Much later than they had intended, the men of the party said goodbye to the women of the party and staggered down the long flights of stone stairs with a boat.
Look at this!
At the dock was an old worn boat.
Why, that was on the ledge! The ledge outside Muvar's chamber!
One of those old men probably towed it in. Now that everyone knows the river is here, there are bound to be people exploring it.
I hope nobody enters the chamber.
Anyone who gets down here will have heard about it. The story is widespread. I wonder that Yoke stood for all our retelling of what even he must have heard.
He was being polite. Anyway, that's what John would have said.
Thus it was that they launched the boat and rowed their way to Muvar's chamber. They entered the smooth chamber. Something struck Kelvin as the three of them prepared to step together into the adjoining world. Those knobs on the outside of the transporter appeared to him to have slightly changed positions. If the knobs had been moved, that might mean that they would not go to their proper destination, and might, for all he knew to the contrary, be unable to return. His gauntlets began to tingle.
Uh-oh.
But even as that thought occurred, he was in motion into the transporter, his body not responding in time. There was a flash of white that covered all existences. The three of them stood in a transporter in a Muvar chamber, but not the one they had entered. Nor was it the chamber in the world of silver serpents. This one was rounded like the others, lighted by strange ovoids on the chamber's walls. It was definitely not the same. The open door was the giveaway. That and the orangish daylight filtering in, revealing a grouping of large prickly plants and an assortment of rocks and heaps of red sand just outside.
This is wrong! We're not where we should be!
Someone changed the settings. I thought those knobs were set differently, but I didn't realize it for sure until...
Don't panic. We'll just step out and step back in, and we should be back where we started. I wonder...
John walked to the doorway.
Father! Don't!
But his father was pushing his head out around the rounded edge of the metal door. Curiosity ruling his actions, he was about to see where they were. His shoulders slumped, and he dropped there in the doorway.
Father!
With a quick leap, Kyan was beside John, grabbing his shoulders, seeking to turn his face. Then, he collapsed on top of his father. Kelvin stared for one horrified moment. Then he snatched out his Muvar weapon from the hip scabbard and leveled it at the doorway. Sparks came from the bell-shaped muzzle.
No magic, then.
He replaced the weapon in its sheath and drew his sword. He took a step for the doorway and the unmoving bodies of his kin. Too late, he saw the small purple fruit lying there. Too late, he realized that he could have stepped back into the transporter and been gone. He breathed a spicy fragrance. He noticed that the sword was slipping from his fingers and that the gauntlet wasn't even trying to hold on. He noticed the floor and the sand and the dust near the doorway. Then he noticed that the fruit was near his face and... Sean Riley, better known as St. Helens, was elated. As the king's own messengers left the cottage's yard, he leaped up into the air, waving his arms like a boy.
Did you hear that, Phil? Did you hear that?
I think all Kelvinia heard it.
The former king of Aretex had been staying temporarily with St. Helens while his hereditary palace was reconditioned to better accommodate the newly appointed government.
We're going to the palace, boy. To the Kelvinia palace that used to be just Rudd's. King Rufert is finally getting around to honoring me proper. And he wants Kelvin and his brother Kyan and John Knight and Les and more Crumb there as well. I tell you, there's going to be a place in the new administration for us, just as I always thought there should be. There may be medals for those of us who fought. Maybe a complete pardon for you.
I'm not going. I wasn't included in the royal command.
Who cares? I'm certain you'll be welcome. You don't know the king. He's the most friendly man in the kingdom.
I was pretty friendly. With you, I mean. I gave you sanctuary, protected you from Melba, and allowed you to beat me at chess.
Allowed me? Why, you young pupkin! All right. So you were a good friend, and you resisted that old witch Melba some, and after I rescued you from defeat, you...
You rescued me? Oh, I see what you're doing. What you call tit for tat?
Tats, correct. Now we're even.
Another game?
Philip was asking for another game of chess.
No. I've got preparations to make. You've got preparations to make. We've got to get to the crumbs. We've got to get to Kelvin and the others before they get to the flaw. What a time for them to take off for a wedding now that there's something important happening.
The messengers will get to them. St. Helens, don't you realize anything about how things are done?
I guess they will. The old man's just a little excited.
A little excited?
I guess we'll all ride together, Phil. I just hope they head off Kelvin and his party in time. I wonder if the girls will ride along. Cursed if I don't think Kelvin's wife, my daughter, should share her husband's and her father's triumph.
Lester and his father were working on a wall when the king's messenger appeared. Les hopped down from the scaffolding, mortar on his hands and the trowel he held, and gazed at them open-mouthed.
Don't get excited, son. It may not be anything bad.
Maybe something good.
I knew I shouldn't have let her go.
Oh, you know you couldn't have stopped her, short of chaining her. And then you'd probably have gotten a lump on your head.
Les unconsciously raised a hand to his sweaty forehead and immediately felt the mortar on it. He would have cursed if the messenger had not been dismounted and there at the gate.
Lester Crumb, Morton Crumb, you are both summoned to appear before His Majesty King Rufert, acting King of Calvinia. You have 3 days to comply.
That sounds more like an order than a request.
I just deliver them. My orders say I'm to tell you 3 days.
Bah, dang king. Double his territory and he treats you like dirt.
I wouldn't have thought it. But maybe it's an honor, a place in the government or something.
Maybe.
John was the first to see the riders approaching. Instantly, her hand was on her sling rock in place, ready just in case history should repeat. But these were no kidnappers from a foreign nation, she saw with relief.
Mrs. Hackleberry, Mrs. Crumb?
Aye?
Your husband, Mrs. Hackleberry, has he gone to the floor?
He, his brother, and their father.
Then we're too late. We were to give them a message. They are supposed to be at the palace in 3 days.
Why? Is there trouble, or...
We're only messengers. You ladies are also summoned. The Crumbs, Lester and Morton, will be there as well. So will the Roundeer, Sean Riley, alias St. Helens.
Alias?
All of us at the palace. Something must have happened.
The messages have been delivered. The king ordered us to stress that you have but 3 days.
You know Mrs. Hackleberry is pregnant. Does Rupert still expect...
Now really, John, you shouldn't. You know...
I know those gold button monkeys weren't polite. What's gotten into Rufert, sending out creates like those? Why, they're not fit to wear the uniforms. Just wait till Kelvin hears. He'll tell them how to talk to his wife and sister.
Hush, John, hush. It doesn't matter.
Yeah? Then what do they mean by alias St. Helens?
I'm sure it was just a misspeaking.
Sure.
They gathered together in the second audience room. Wine was brought, and all sipped it except John. Of the five, only St. Helens was smiling.
I'd guess we're about to get our due. Even you, John, for riding with the Round Ear.
Curtains were pulled open by two lackeys in royal livery. There sat King Rufert on his throne. Instead of his crown, he wore an absurd, tight-fitting stockle cap. He also wore a deep frown, which was even more unusual for him.
Hackleberry, Crumbs, and Sean Riley, alias St. Helens, you have been summoned to my presence without explanation. You are wondering why.
Your Majesty, I suspect the recent conflict with Aerotex and its annexing has a little something to do with it.
Roundy, I did not give you permission to speak. My patience has been severely strained lately. Do not strain it further. You know, of course, about Klingland and Kant's, those two related kingdoms ruled by Brett's Kildom and Kildee. Long have they been a thorn in your kingdom's side.
But, Your Majesty... There's never been trouble between our kingdoms. Never in all of history.
You're a historian, Crumb?
No, Your Majesty, but it's common knowledge. With other of the Seven Kingdoms, such as Aerotex, before we annexed it, there might have been trouble, but never...
Silence! You will not interrupt again. Not on pain of torture. As I was saying, there have always been difficulties... Only recently it has come to my attention that these two kingdoms plan aggressive war. We must take action before they invade our territory. The Round Ear should have known this. Uniting four, the prophecy says. But just when the hero is needed, he's gone. Probably dallying with wenches in a far foreign land.
Your Majesty, I protest.
Silence. Do not presume that because you are mated to the Round Ear and carry his brat, that you are above punishment. So they plan aggression, and we must move fast. Fortunately, there is another kingdom willing to be our ally, Hermandy.
Hermandy? But Hermandy has always been...
Be silent!
I'm sorry, Your Majesty. I did not mean to interrupt.
Do not do so again. As I was saying, the situation is critical. Obviously, I will have no help from the Round Ear, so I am ordering you male Crumbs to lead troops into Klingland and Kant's. And you, Riley, do you have that belt that allowed you to fly?
No, Your Majesty, Kelvin has that, as well as the gauntlets and the Muvar weapon.
Typical. Irresponsible in an agency of prophecy. But never mind that. You are ordered to proceed forthwith to Hermandy as my personal messenger to King Bitler.
Your Majesty, I've never been
to... Those are your orders.
Are you refusing to obey?
No, Your Majesty. It's just that I haven't been to Hermandy and I haven't dealt with kings.
You dealt with Philip of Aretix?
Yes, Your Majesty, but... though I haven't had the honor to serve you in such a capacity before, I certainly will now.
And you, Crumbs?
We certainly will follow your orders, Your Majesty. Though neither of us have been in uniform since the recent war, we'll endeavor to serve you as we must.
You will do that.
Rufford's dour attention now turned to Helm.
Since your errant husband is not here, you will stay at the palace until he returns, or the royal physician delivers you of child, whichever event occurs first. And you, John Huckleberry, sister to the hero and mate to Lester Crumb, you will stay with her as her companion. Is that acceptable?
Very acceptable.
Then this audience is at an end.
When they were alone, getting their breath, getting their color back, John said what she had been thinking.
He's not.
Lass, I've thought that myself. But if he isn't who he looks like, then...
That other king, I think. The one Kelvin talked about.
King Roforth of Hud? King Roforth of the torture chamber and the serpents?
Well, who else?
But how...
I don't know. I thought they were going to execute him.
Kelvin wouldn't execute anybody in cold blood.
A pity, maybe. He must have escaped. It has to be. How else?
I don't know. But it just doesn't make sense. Even if his own people didn't kill him and he got here, there's Rufford.
Which is why we have to play along, Father, for the sake of the real king.
You really think he's not?
Don't you?
Well, kings will be kings, as the saying goes. It could be he's had a lot on his mind. Maybe his imprisonment is catching up with him. A gear loose somewhere. A bad situation coming up. A bad time for it.
You don't believe that?
No. We'd better do just as this one says. If he's not the Rufford we fought for, then it will be out with him.
And if there's a war started as a result?
There is the prophecy.
St. Helens! You really want to be fighting again? I thought you'd had enough after your crossbow wound and after old Melba.
Yes, it was a close thing. But Kelvin did come back in time, didn't he? Just in time. Right, John?
We stopped her.
St. Helen smiled. He liked the idea of a war that would fulfill that prophecy line. Kelvin opened his eyes to see a squat, ugly being with a head growing out of its shoulders and no neck at all. The being was crouched down, turning the Muvar weapon over and over in webbed, long-fingered hands. The creature's arms and legs and webbed toes matched its fingers. On either side of the blunt head were round, flat spots resembling those on the head of a Froog. More than anything, it seemed like a giant Froog with human additions. As he turned, he could see the others of his party, also conscious.
Oh... we're not where we should be. I'm sorry, Kelvin, you were right. The controls in the transporter were tampered with.
You god hunters, go to God.
We're not god hunters.
We see. We see. God see. God sees all.
There won't be any wedding. I'm sorry, Kelvin. Father?
You didn't bring us, son. We came of our own accord. We'll get this straightened out, and then we'll go to the right place and get you and Lonnie married as planned.
You go to God. Strangers. Tribute. Tribute. Strangers.
As it spoke, another of the creatures was poking a stick with sticky needles on it into the Muvar weapon's bell-shaped muzzle. Its webbed fingers touched and squeezed the trigger. Pretty sparks amused the meddler, doing no harm. There was no hostile magic, so the display was entirely meaningless.
I'd say these are real primitives, not sophisticates like the flop ears.
You go to God. You go to God, all of you together, to God.
Persistent devil. You guys have any idea of how to define a god hunter?
One who hunts a god?
Where was that belt? With it, Kelvin could extricate them all from this predicament. One of the Frugiers was strutting about wearing the belt over its naked loins.
Oh boy. Maybe it won't.
Just then, it did. Webbed fingers found and pressed the pretty red button. The fumbler fumbled some more. Off he went, first to the east, and then to the west, and finally smacked into a prickly tree. The adventurer pushed the red button again, fell partway, landed in greenish mud, and got up. A quick roll in a pile of red sand, and he approached the leader and held out the soiled but unharmed belt.
Did we win one, Father? Are they going to think twice before croaking us in some form of sacrifice?
I'd like to think so, son. These aren't flop ears. Maybe they've got something like our dragons and maybe something like the serpents the flop ears sacrificed to. But if they've got the brains of a flea-house, they'll be impressed.
After a suitable interval, during which all their gear was examined and re-examined, the leader gave orders. The prisoners were lifted and carried on slippery, smooth Frugir shoulders. The creatures might look clumsy, but they were quite strong. Behind them, Kelvin managed to discern, other green shoulders carried everything they had brought that was not presently attached to them, including all weapons. They were carried an interminable distance, through vast expanses of swamp, between prickly tree trunks that looked like something that ought to be growing in a desert, past huge piles of reddish sand, sometimes shading to an orange, the color of the sky of this world. Through brush growth and greenish water, and up from patches of semi-liquid land. Swamp creatures, like alladiles, splashed out of their way, snapping great toothy snouts, slapping broad tails that made muddy waves.
Father, do you think one of those is their god?
Let's just try to wait and be surprised.
The Frugirs repositioned their loads. Then they were in the lake itself, wading and finally swimming with their powerful hind legs. Somehow, the Frugirs kept them above the surface. They splashed up a ramp. There, concealed until now by the black thorny tree branches, was a huge gate. The Frugirs put their prisoners down on a dry surface and backed off. Kelvin saw some of them as they dipped back below the scum. Bubbles traced their route away from the island.
Tribute? They've brought their tribute!
In an aperture high in the wall, there was suddenly a woman's comforting face. She wore a coppery crown on coppery tresses, with coppery rings dangling from two definitely rounded, not pointed ears. She was, Kelvin had to notice, a beauty. But what could such a woman be doing here in this ironically godforsaken place?
Tribute. Thank you so much, Kelvin Hackleberry. Oh, and you, John Knight, trying so hard to get that knot untied. What a great pleasure to meet someone whose original home is far down the floor. With your son, Kelvin, a hero. And your other son, Kyan, wanting to wed his true love in still another frame. Oh, but you mustn't judge by appearances. I am more, very much more than you can imagine.
But human, a human being who thinks and speaks and has the power of life and death. That is correct, isn't it? You do have the power either to save us or destroy us.
Why, of course I have those powers, Kelvin. What do you think I am? Physically?
Kelvin tried not to picture the phenomenal contours he was sure her body had, hidden by the wall.
Ah, you are married, so you hesitate to conjecture. Yet suppose I were to offer you your freedom in return for that conjecture. Oh, it would be delightful to make you do with me what you so dread. Perhaps I should indeed free you, instead of saving you for a late night snack.
Late night snack?
Go on, Kelvin. It's such a pleasure following your thoughts.
She's a witch.
A witch? Me? Oh, shame on you, Kelvin. A hero of your stripe should know better. You have heard of me, or of something like me. Certainly your father has. He told you too, though you thought he was speaking nonsense. And you as well, Kyan. Indeed, I am not like your mother.
Mavania, do you always have to play with our food?
Of course I do, Merton. And why not? Aren't human females and felines that way? Here I have almost coaxed this innocent young man into lusting after my luscious torso. Oh, it can be fun accomplishing that. Oh, now, Grumpus, you know it's not really feeding time yet. Yes, I agree. We will have to show ourselves, but it's going to be a surprise, particularly for Kelvin, who is resolutely focusing on my forbidden sex appeal. Kyan is thinking of his Lani. and John of his Charlane, and another named Zenon. Naughty, naughty John. Only one can be your wife. But you, Kelvin, you are thinking of me, and that is the naughtiest of all.
That's not entirely true. I'm thinking also of Helen.
Yes, that night you got her pregnant. But now she is gravid and doesn't look quite like that, whereas I may...
Ravania's face moved away from the wall opening as if shoved aside. Replacing it was a man's face. Coppery eyebrows and copper warrior helmet emphasizing high cheekbones and a bulging forehead.
Ravania? These aren't even fat!
But it will be fun fattening them up. If I could somehow pose as Kelvin pictures me, voluptuous, almost naked, plying him with succulent grapes.
The man's face disappeared. Then in the opening appeared the snout of a dragon. Its scales were copper rather than a more normal gold, and the eyes it turned down on them were as coppery as its scales.
Father! Kyan!
I think I know what it is. Remember when I was telling you stories about Greek myth? Remember...
With horror, Kelvin realized that his father was helplessly rolling his eyes as if stricken. Magic used against him by Mervania? Magic used so that he would not talk?
You are quite right, Kelvin. I did stop your father from speaking. A simple paralysis hold on his vocal cords. It's wrong for him to want to spoil your surprise. I'd much rather share your naughty vision of me leaning forward to feed you a delicacy. My breasts becoming more visible as my gown falls away. Their delightful contours. Exactly how does that go after that?
Kelvin thought desperately of what his father had been saying. Greek myth all mixed up with history and therefore partially true. There had been Medusa, a monstrous woman with hair filled with living, hissing snakes.
Keep thinking, Kelvin. Keep thinking. There was also Circe, with whom Odysseus dallied for 20 years before returning to his wife. Now there was an example for you. Will poor little Helm weave a tapestry by day and unravel it by night, waiting for your return?
I think I know! It's...
Coppery eyes glanced at his brother.
You can, Kelvin. You just have to try. You are getting warm, as you used to say in that children's game. Multiple heads. Yes, that's close. But do you recall the particular mythical being that caused you the most terror? I'll give you a clue. It wasn't your wife's namesake, Helen of Troy. Oh, excuse me. She was named after her father, a figure of quite another nature. A great hero fought this one, Kelvin. But then they always did, in your father's frame. One of us visited that world back in its infancy, and that's the source.
Kelvin felt as though he were failing a test. All he could think about was the face at the aperture and whether there was any clothing on what was below it. And his bonds, his father, and his brother.
Dunce! I tire of this. I'll show you my fascinating body. I'm coming out!
The gate swung wide. Back of the opening, Kelvin saw a walk, a garden, and a building. Then the face, the beautiful woman's face, was peeking around the gatepost.
Mervania!
The face kept coming. It was on a long, coppery-scaled neck.
A serpent woman! I knew it! God, she's a snake!
Oh, fiddle!
On clawed feet, a coppery-scaled body of immense size. Beside her head, a dragon's head, and beside the dragon's, Merton's. All three heads were on the front of a body that was all coppery scales, but was otherwise that of a Scorpio crab in all but size. Great pincers reached in front, while at either of the monster's two sides were two human arms. Scaly, feminine ones on Mervania's side, scaly, muscle-bulging ones on Merton's. On the farthest end of the body, coming up last, the tapering crustacean posterior and the long sting, this one of copper.
Chimera!
Chimera!
Chimera. A monster that had to be far smarter and even more dangerous than the one the ancient Greeks had known. St. Helens rode the big gray warhorse down the country road, musing to himself as he shooed a buzzing insect away from his black beard. It was a sunny, nice day for a ride, but this was to be a long one.
St. Helens! St. Helens!
He turned in his saddle to see the former boy king, Philip Blastmore, riding down on him.
Damn! I thought I told you to stay. This is official. Damn it, I don't need a kid along.
I'm coming to keep you out of trouble.
You keep me out of trouble? You, young Pupton, have been trouble since you were hatched.
I wasn't hatched. I was found under a rock, same as you.
Probably you were. And old Melba then took complete charge of you.
I'm sorry, St. Helens. If you really don't want me along...
Now where'd you get a dumb idea like that? Of course I want you along. Glad to have your company. What would I do for trouble without you?
But you said...
I say a lot of things. Curse of the Irish. One of the curses, anyhow. Haven't I taught you about jokes?
Yes. Like when you said, that girl has nice jugs, when anyone could see she carried wine bottles.
You happen to notice anything else about her, lad?
She had an excellent figure. I'm surprised you didn't realize that.
Maybe next time.
I can really be a lot of help, you know. I was king once, if only in name. I can tell you the protocol that's expected, and then you won't embarrass us.
Tell you what, Phil. If you catch the old saint crapping on the carpet, you speak right up.
Oh, I will, St. Helens, I will. Only you didn't do that, even in Aratax. I'd have smelled it if you had.
Let's just say that I'll appreciate your help, whenever and however.
But Philip was now looking back the way they had come. A horse was approaching with a rider. As the horse drew closer, the uniform of a palace guard was evident.
Now, why would one of those fellows be riding after me? Something new come up?
Messenger Riley, I'm from the palace detail, but I'm on my own. I've heard a lot about you, how you fought the witch and all. Sir, I'm Charlie Lomax.
I recognize you, close enough. What's the urgency?
It's for your ears alone, St. Helens.
You can speak in front of Phil, I trust him.
Sir, I beg permission to accompany you on your mission to Hermandy.
The king send you?
No, sir. As I said, I'm doing this on my own.
You mean you're deserting your post?
I mean, I wish to serve the true interest of my king and country. I know that you do too, Messenger Riley, so...
You serve your king by deserting him?
I don't believe the man at the palace is the king.
You did right. Very right. Certainly you can accompany me. And call me St. Helens.
Thank you, sir. St. Helens, sir.
They rode on together, the three of them, on Messenger Riley's mission to Hermandy. Lester, sweating under the new bronzed helmet with its Ostark feather marking him as officer, reviewed the assembled troops. He felt, he had to admit to himself, and only to himself, like a total fool. Here he was pretending to be an officer when he had never before been one, serving a king who was probably an imposter. He couldn't have said why. It was one bad, bad situation. He pulled the reins on his horse's bridle and steered around the huge wheels on the last catapult in line toward his father.
General Father, you see anything wrong with these?
Top notch. The finest mercenaries and equipment Throod had.
Yes, the finest bought fighters. Good soldiers all, and not the sort to doubt. You want to make the speech, Father? You've got the wind for it.
Moore gave him an almost invisible frown, then stepped his horse around the catapult.
Men, we're about to march into Klingland and Kantz, the twin kingdoms ruled by twin brothers. Half of you will go to Klingland. Half will go with my son, General Lester Crumb, into Kantz. While we're marching, Sean Riley, whom you know as St. Helens, hero of the war with Aratex, will be on a secret mission to secure Hermandy as an ally. Our armies will meet after victory in the twin capital of Lanris on the Themsen River. Any questions?
As Les had expected, there were none.
Then we march. And may the gods smile and bring us united to an easy victory.
Helen was worried, and she let Dr. Stirk know it. It wasn't that she had any great faith in the physician as anything other than a doctor, but talk she must.
Hmm.
Young lady, you say the king is not the king and—
Yes, yes! He must be that lookalike Kelvin told us about. If he is, he's got round ears like mine and Kelvin's. He can't have pointed ears like you and King Rufert.
I think, young lady, that you're imagining things. Many women think strange things when they're with child.
Damn it, doctor. You can at least look, can't you? King Rufert never wore a stockle cap in his life. This king always wears one pulled down around his ears. Isn't that strange?
Young lady, the king is the king. What he wants, he does. It's not for you or I or any other subject to question.
Horse droppings! We have to find out if it's the king with the round ears. You have to find out!
Young lady, you're being most difficult.
Darn right! And I intend to be more difficult. Either you get a look at his ears and tell me that they are pointed, or I'll leave the palace.
Leave the palace? Really? That would never be allowed. I have my orders. Your husband wouldn't want
me here if the king is the evil impostor.
Calm yourself. It's not good for you to get excited. For the sake of the child, be calm.
I'll be calm if you check his ears. Will you?
Yes, yes, I will try to. But the king isn't acting irrationally. For a king. Kings are different. He may be losing his hair, or it may be turning grey, so he's covering it up. Kings can be even more vain than women.
Forget the hair, check the ears!
I will try. If it's the hair that is disturbing him, I can prescribe a magic ointment.
Now, doctor.
Dr. Stirk went to the chamber door as if dismissed by royalty. Helen lay back on her pillow in the big four-poster bed and sighed. How totally unlike her. But it was necessary.
Suppose it is Roforth. Suppose it is that evil king Kelvin encountered. What of Kelvin? What of your grandson? What of all Kelvin's gains?
How's she doing, Doctor?
John stood outside the chamber and caught the royal physician exiting.
Delusional, I'm afraid. She has this fear that other frame folk are coming here. She thinks our king is the one your brother helped defeat in the other frame.
I think she's right. As a matter of fact, I know it.
She wants me to look at the king's ears.
So do I. Is there risk?
With royalty, Mrs. Cran, there's always risk.
Not with the real King Rufert. Remember how he laughed? Remember how he enjoyed a joke? Oh, this king seems never to enjoy anything.
I remember his manner. Perhaps some sorcery has brought about a change.
You will find out.
If he'll let me. Yes. Yes, I will try.
When, Doctor?
I suppose I must request that he have an examination. If he refuses...
Tell him it's his regular examination. He won't know.
I suppose...
Now, Doctor.
Oh, very well.
Dr. Stirk entered the royal bedchamber and stopped. The king stood there wearing his stockle cap and nothing else.
Well, doctor, I haven't all day.
Knowing the king's usual routines, Dr. Stirk doubted that. Nevertheless, that was his signal to go to work. He tested the king's muscle tone, excellent, listened to his heart, beating strongly, and tested his breathing, powerful, like that of an athlete. He checked everything that he was supposed to, except for the ears.
Well?
Your ears, Your Majesty?
What about my ears?
You're wearing a stockle cap. I need to look in your ears for bugs and...
You think I've got bugs in my ears?
It's just the regular checkup, Your Majesty.
No, very well.
The king whipped off the covering. Dr. Stirk blinked. Those women had been so convincing. But here were two ears as pointed as he had ever seen. A little bit cleaner than he expected, and not quite so hairy, but...
What are you doing there?
Nothing, Your Majesty. Why do you wear the stockle cap?
Why? Because I want to.
Oh.
I caught a little head cold in the ruins. Started giving me the sniffles, but they're gone now.
Yes.
Now, just what was a head cold? And what was sniffles? Some sort of curse? But the king was right about one thing. He was healthy now. Dr. Stirk was quite relieved when he finally left the royal presence. It was strange being picked up and carried by two left scaly human female arms and two right scaly male arms. Kelvin watched the bulge in the male pectoral muscles where they joined the side of the creature. He hardly dared look at the female side, where he imagined there was a bit of breast beneath the coppery sheen.
I hate to disillusion your fond conjectures, but my kind don't have breasts. Perhaps if my body was of the goatish nature envisioned by Earth's Greeks, I'd have an udder or two on my chest. But as you can see, my main body is of the crustacea.
Yes, he had noticed. Oh, did those pincers feel hard. He was almost disappointed that her body had turned out so unlike his guilty expectation.
Why, thank you, Kelvin.
Now they were descending a ramp. At the bottom, a door was ajar, and his father and brother lay still bound hand and foot with the Frugir's vines. There was a third individual, unbound, rather plump, wearing a suit of transparent body-covering armor. Through the armor, he could see a body-length undergarment that showed neither seams nor fasteners. The stranger had dark, red, wire-like hair, a stern slash of a mouth, and ears that were not quite round as his own, but pear-shaped.
Why didn't you run out?
At that moment, the Chimera dumped him on the floor.
Because, stupid, it's Chimera.
Kelvin noted the iron ring set in the stone wall. This place was evidently a dungeon beneath a castle. There were piles of straw for beds. The only other furniture was a trough that stood chest high and held an assortment of chopped fruits in some sort of gruel. Kelvin could not believe the mouth-watering smell coming from that trough, and he realized that his stomach was really empty.
Go ahead, eat, all of you. Make yourselves fat. If the monster eats you first, that's longer for me.
Goodbye for now.
All to your appetites.
Grumpus, no tasting!
With astonishing ease, the huge, mixed-up beast turned and left. The cell was not really dark. Light filtered down to them from narrow slits spaced at intervals near the ceiling.
I would have thought there was nothing worse than a golden dragon or a silver serpent. But Chimera, for God's sake, and copper!
Where you stupids been? A Chimera could eat your golden dragons and silver serpents for breakfast. Most probably have.
You've encountered them? Other frames?
Certainly. You think other worlds don't have transporters?
Kyan tiptoed to the door. He listened for a moment, then walked back.
It's gone. I don't think it's listening.
So we can speak freely now, huh?
We've never been here before. In our frame, the Chimera is thought to be only legend.
You're here by accident?
Why else? Why else would anyone come here?
For the Chimera, of course. Just for the sting of it.
We're all on the same horse. We might as well get to know one another. I'm Kelvin, Knight Hackleberry. This is my father, John Knight. This is my half-brother, Kyan Knight. Father came to our frame by accident, and together we came to this frame by accident. We were hoping to arrive in a world like ours, but with silver serpents instead of golden dragons.
Real novices, huh? Call me Stapular. I'm a hunter. I'm here by design. I'm the last of my party that's left.
The others in your party, they were...
Destroyed, of course. Damned locals' fault. They interfered, or we'd have gotten it.
You mean a superior frame-jumping party came here to find a Chimera and was captured by lowly Frugirs?
You want your nose flattened, round ear?
He just wants information. We all do.
Do, huh?
And exchange. Though there's little we can tell you that will help.
Nothing I could tell you that will help you either.
We were captured by Frugirs. That fruit they rolled into our chamber.
You fell for that, huh? Ha!
Yes, we are, I guess you'd have to say, unseasoned in frame travel. We didn't know this world existed. And as I've mentioned, we thought Chimera's a myth.
Mistake, wasn't it? Well, I'll tell you, Kelvin. Unlike your round-eared trash, some of us travel freely to any world not proscribed.
Proscribed?
By the Green Dwarves. You've heard of them?
No, unless Muvar is one.
Muvar is. He visits the Miners. My world is Major.
The Major worlds? They have more magic?
Magic? Does this...
Stapular tapped his transparent armor.
Look like magic?
To us it does. But then we're ignorant.
Yours must be a science world then, like Earth.
You claim to be from a science world?
More science than magic. As a matter of fact, magic isn't supposed to exist, though some in my frame do believe in it.
Then you are science.
Sort of. We were just getting around to discovering frame worlds, perhaps, and...
Horseless carriages? Flying machines? Moving and talking pictures? Boxes with little people imaged inside?
That's primitive science. You say you were discovering frame worlds?
Not me personally, my people.
Then you went from a primitive major to an even more primitive minor?
If that means science world and magic world, yes. It was all an accident with us. Can't you tell us how you came here?
It wasn't Frugears, it was Square Ears. They live here, but separate from Frugears. They're brighter than Frugears, but minors. They tried to keep us hunters out. When we ignored their ludicrous laws, they used magic. They're protecting this last of the Chimera, even bringing in copper. Damn fools. If they realized what the sting is worth on other worlds...
You're merchants. Traders. Not only hunters, but dealers. In fact, from what you say, you're poachers.
You think we'd risk Chimera for the fun of it?
No, I doubt that you'd risk Chimera except for some great profit.
The Square Ears don't know the sting's value. No way they can use the transporter and find out. Only Round Ears and those like us can use the transporter here. The dwarves have the transporter's booby-trapped to keep miners from mixing too much with majors, and vice versa.
These Square Ears who live here, how'd they stop you?
Magic, of course. They used a spell before we could act. We didn't know they were around, and then we were paralyzed. Our weapons useless. One of those time lock spells you probably know about.
Paralysis, we understand, but time lock?
Time stoppage in a small area. Gives them time. Very unscientific.
Magic, then.
Magic.
These Square Ears, they just left you for the Chimera?
They left us for the Frugears. The Frugears delivered us and all of our equipment.
Then it was just the same as for us, only we didn't encounter Square Ears.
Right.
And the others in your party?
Eaten, one by one.
By the Chimera? That doesn't seem possible.
Huh, a lot you know about it.
I didn't say it didn't happen, only it does seem strange. On any world I've ever been on, eating something as intelligent as your species is unheard of.
You're not as intelligent, stupid. Not even I am.
I see.
Could the Square Ears stop the Chimera? With their time lock?
Magic is magic. Why'd they want to try?
The door swung wide and there was Merton Head and Grumpus Head beside Mervania Head. The Scorpio Crab body scuttled inside. Mervania looked down on them while Merton added more food to their trough from a large bucket. Deliberately, teasingly, she lifted something large and green to her mouth and sank her pretty white teeth into it. It was a forearm, green with little seeds stuck to it, fingers, a thumb, a pickled arm.
Oh, really, Kelvin? It's as you thought, a pickle. Pickled arm, very tasty with added copper. And you, Stapula, I'm thinking of a new recipe. First, I'll dip you in lye while you're alive, and then...
Mervania, don't give away your recipes.
Oh, all right. I'll just leave that for a surprise.
We've slapped the stock. Let's go.
Spoil sport.
Tail raised over its back, the Chimera departed.